Welcome to Nuclear Energy in Korea, a podcast to promote discussion of major issues and challenges in U.S. and Korean nuclear energy. I'm Alan Ahn, and I'll be your host today. Today, I'm speaking with Mr. Craig Piercy, Washington representative for the American Nuclear Society, or ANS. In addition to his role at ANS, Mr. Piercy also heads the Washington office of the Bose Public Affairs Group as Managing Director of Federal Relations. He brings considerable experience as a Congressional Chief of Staff, House Appropriations Committee staff member, and longtime government relations professional. Mr. Piercy, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure.
Mr. Piercy, could you speak a bit about the role and activities of the American Nuclear Society and also about how you got involved in nuclear policy work?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the American Nuclear Society is represents the what I would call the American nuclear community. So it's the technical people that are involved not only in the nuclear energy industry but also in universities, nuclear engineering departments of universities, government agencies like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Department of Energy, the National Nuclear Security Administration, even DOE and EPA, and also our nation's national laboratories. So we try to represent the broad interests of the nuclear community, of which industry is only one part, but we tend to think of ourselves as wearing the white hats because we don't really have a direct commercial interest here. What you really have is a group of enthusiasts that really truly believe in the power of nuclear technology to address society's problems in the long term, and see the ANS as an instrument to communicate that support and the value of nuclear technology. My background, I worked on Capitol Hill for a number of years back in the 1990s, and my first experience with nuclear was working for a member of Congress who was also a member of the Energy and Water Appropriations Subcommittee. And so I did a lot of the subcommittee work, and I would say both my boss and I got very interested in nuclear fairly early on, probably because a large part of the energy and water budget is devoted to nuclear in some form,
sure.
Nuclear technology in some form or another. But I really got to know more about the technology and really appreciated that it can be a positive force for change. So I've represented the American Nuclear Society since 2005. I left the Hill to work for a university for a few years, but it truly is one of my greatest pleasures is to serve as the industry's representative, the community's representative here in Washington.
So the U.S. currently has 100 reactors that produce approximately 20% of the country's electricity. Currently, the largest nuclear generating country in the world, and yet in recent years, a number of nuclear plants in the U.S. have faced premature retirement. In some cases due to competition from cheap shale gas. How does the industry weather this current storm?
Well, Alan, I'm an optimist, and so I think that the forecast for nuclear is cloudy today, sunny tomorrow. I think that obviously the nuclear energy generation industry today is under a lot of pressures. You mentioned the cheap shale gas. You also have this scenario in places in the Midwest where wind energy is feeding into the grid in a negative pricing scenario, which is obviously difficult for some nuclear plants. But in other parts of the nation, the vast majority of nuclear plants today are still valuable, productive, and profitable. So I think that we're in a situation now where we've been through a period of slack electricity demand in this country. Any gaps in energy supply that we've had to fill have been very easily filled by natural gas generation. But I do believe that this economy is going to start growing in a more purposeful way, in the next few years. Incremental energy demand is going to continue to increase. Renewables and gas certainly have a role, but it's obviously important to maintain some diversity in your energy supply. And I believe that nuclears will see better days ahead. Already you see in Florida, NextEra is moving forward with the Turkey Point, the new Turkey Point plant. So I don't think all the news is bad. And I think that as the economy gets better, that the outlook for nuclear will get better as well. And certainly, and I'm sure we'll talk about it later in the interview, but the EPA carbon rules that were announced last week, I think will certainly have an impact.
Well, on this topic of EPA's carbon rules, nuclear certainly produces a majority of America's emissions-free electricity, and protecting the environment and mitigating carbon emissions has clearly been a major priority of this administration, and yet all of the focus appears to be on renewable sources of energy. Why do you think this has been the case, and how do you think we can shift some of the attention towards nuclear as a major solution to the carbon problem?
So, it's still early days with the carbon rule. It's been out for about a week or so, and we're still, pouring through it to try to understand some of the intricacies of it. Certainly from a public outreach standpoint, the discussion about the carbon rule has focused on efficiency and renewables as these sort of baskets or principles that the EPA would apply to each state. I think that if you look at the rule itself, it's fairly technology neutral. They tend to come up with state level targets based on what they believe is achievable, and nuclear has certainly been a factor in that calculus. I think that politically, it's easier to talk about renewables than it is to talk about nuclear. Sure. Nuclear will always have its detractors, and so it's easy to talk about the more politically popular aspects, but I do believe that the administration does, when they look at the numbers and they look at what they hope to achieve with this rule, that they recognize that nuclear is going to play a role. And even if they may not play that up to at the risk of angering certain constituencies, I think that they recognize that nuclear is an important component of the solution.
Well, nuclear has certainly been touted as clean air energy, and yet there is political deadlock over climate and clean air issues, and the public appears to be somewhat divorced from concerns regarding the climate. What are or what do you think should be the major selling points for nuclear to the public and also to key policymakers here in Washington?
So, we are in a situation where the U.S. doesn't have a national energy policy. And I think that you can ask the question, and it's a legitimate question, as to whether or not we are equipped politically to have a national energy policy. The mantra in Washington today is all of the above, right? We support everything, let 1,000 flowers bloom, there's no one way to do this. I think that nuclear has been operating safely and reliably in this country for a long period of time. And in a way, it's unfortunate that the only time people pay attention to nuclear is when something bad happens. Mm. But I do think that the current challenges that nuclear faces now begin to focus people's attention to the benefits that it provides, right? 60% of our non-emitting energy electricity generation comes from nuclear. The fact that the plants have a capacity factor of 90%, they're up all the time, they're reliable. I think that people are beginning, you don't ever really truly appreciate something unless you're at risk of losing it, and my hope is that we don't, nuclear doesn't suffer, we don't see too many plant closures, and in the process of watching what's going on today, that there's a broader appreciation for the benefits that it provides. So I think people are realizing, I think people up on Capitol Hill realize it. I think the people that are involved in energy policy recognize that there is no credible way for the U.S. to tangibly reduce carbon emissions, maintain the diversity of its portfolio without nuclear. And so how exactly that happens still remains to be seen, but I think that people are beginning to realize that nuclear is an indispensable part of the portfolio.
One of the major themes or concepts that you have consistently endorsed and talked about is that nuclear power should be considered more than just a clean energy option or an alternative for the U.S., but that it should be considered a national security imperative. Could you elaborate what you mean by this?
Yeah, so, you know, based in sort of building off the last question, because we have a greater role for the private market in energy generation in this country, and that large portions of our electrical grid have been deregulated, you have commercial generation, market pricing for energy, that we tend to look at the provision of energy as a market-driven good, and we don't tend to favor one option over the other. We tend to look at it in terms of what can you get for the kilowatt hour and what's clean and what's not. But there's a larger point that I think oftentimes people don't adequately consider, which is that there is a nuclear renaissance going on in this world. I mean, we're going from 6 billion people to 10 billion people. Our energy needs are going to effectively double in the next 20 to 30 years. If you look at the past history of energy consumption across the globe, the arrow is going straight up. There are dozens of countries around the world that have not had a nuclear program that are considering adding nuclear to their generation portfolio. And they're starting from scratch. They're building regulatory systems. They are they're looking to integrate nuclear into their grids, changing their grids around to accept nuclear. And it's really important, I think, for the U.S. to be involved and at the table as those things happen. Obviously, the international nuclear marketplace is now multipolar in a way that it wasn't 20 or 30 years ago. We're not the only ones that are purveyors of this technology. And so as countries begin to develop nuclear generation resources, it's important for the U.S. to be engaged. And the only way that the U.S. can be engaged is if it has a strong portfolio of products and services that right now are still driven in large part by our domestic markets. So in a way, we have to be, in order to be strong internationally, we have to be strong domestically. And I think that it's important for policymakers at all levels to realize that it isn't just about energy. It's also about our global security and our ability to impact the safety and security norms of the rest of the world.
How has this message of nuclear as national security imperative been received by the various communities here in Washington, in Congress, think tank community?
I think that the more people understand about nuclear and how it's used today and what's going on in the rest of the world, I think they inherently get that. I think where you have challenges are places, and whether it's up on Capitol Hill, members of Congress, or people that work in other issues in Washington that don't pay attention to nuclear all day long. You know, if you walked up to the average person on the street and said, hey, would it be a safer world if the U.S. exported nuclear reactors to countries in the developing world, their initial reaction would probably be no, right? Because we don't want that stuff going around the world. But the more people learn about the challenges we have from a climate standpoint, from providing energy and facilitating this growth and prosperity that we expect in the developing world, and that the proliferation risks of commercial nuclear reactor technology isn't as great as one might assume without full knowledge, the more people know, the more they get it. And so really it's our challenge as ANS and as part of the broader nuclear community to do that kind of public outreach to broaden the understanding of why U.S. engagement's important. So it's uneven, it's spotty, but I think we're having some positive impact.
Okay. Well, so as you mentioned earlier, the global nuclear renaissance is going on, whether the U.S. likes it or not. And this reality is a lot different from, you know, many decades ago when the U.S. basically had a monopoly over nuclear power technology. And you hinted at this a bit earlier, but in what significant ways has the global nuclear marketplace evolved over the years?
Well, I think that, I mean, if you look at where we were in the 1950s, Atoms for Peace, where the U.S. policy was one of we wanted to share this technology throughout the world, and it was easy for us to say that at the time because we pretty much had a kill switch on who could have it and who couldn't have it. Of course, the world has changed. You have other players in the marketplace: England, France, Japan, Korea, Russia, China. Again, it's this multipolar world, and it's much more competitive. And so, so I think that has the developments in the marketplace have accelerated beyond our understanding of where the U.S. current position is. We're still a leader in the technology. There may be other countries that are building more reactors than we are. But in terms of our licensing framework, in terms of our the designs that are out there, whether it's the AP1000 or the M-Power or NuScale or the TerraPower reactor, a lot of the innovation in the industry still exists in the U.S. And so we still have a leadership role. But I think it's also important to acknowledge that the supply chain is becoming increasingly internationalized and also very interdependent now, where the U.S. doesn't just build reactors with 100% U.S. part content anymore. They partner with other nations and businesses around the world. Those supply chains are internationalized. And that's not a bad thing. I think that like you see the same in automobiles, you see it in aircraft parts. That's the way the economy is moving, and a robust international marketplace for nuclear goods and services has its own rewards in the sense that, you know, no one country is beholden to any other. No one country has to feel like they have to develop their own indigenous enrichment technology for their three reactors, because there is an international marketplace for that kind of technology, and it's all under IAEA safeguards. So it's changed, and there's some that would love to turn back the clock and for the U.S. to control all the technology. There's some that don't realize we don't do that anymore. But I think the practical reality is that the U.S. still has a strong position within that marketplace.
What international and trade export policies do you believe need to be put in place in order to better address this reality of, as you said, a more multipolar nuclear world?
So I think that for the U.S., the challenge is that oftentimes U.S. industry is competing against state-sponsored counterparts in other nations. And so, whereas if you are Rosatom, you basically control all the elements of production, you control finance, there is an advantage to having, you know, a certain level of integration here, whereas in the U.S., the trade promotion, the supply chain, there are all these different nodes to the industry that all have to fly in very close formation in order for it to work well. So there, I think there has to be a greater level of coordination between government and industry to create a united front or you know, Team USA is one concept that's been out there that I think has got some value to it. But we also need to be able to improve our export control laws so that it's easier for U.S. suppliers and consultants to work with other nations to develop their programs. I think that we have to improve our the ease by which we can negotiate and put into force civilian nuclear cooperation agreements with other nations, so that we're not left behind, where other nations' bilateral agreements happen fairly quickly and without a lot of drama, and ours take a lot longer. We've got to be more agile, and that really, at the end of the day, is a challenge that is both industries and governments, and we've got to find a way to be able to work together. And I think this administration gets it, and they're moving toward it, but there's still room to move.
Okay. Well, on this topic of civil nuclear cooperation agreements, an agreement was just concluded with Vietnam. As of this interview, the U.S.-Vietnam 123 is currently under review in Congress. However, there's been some resistance to this agreement in some circles because it does not completely clamp down on Vietnam's future flexibility or options regarding the development of the nuclear fuel cycle, and opposition to other agreements on the horizon, such as with Saudi Arabia, have basically also been opposed on more or less similar grounds. Is the full picture being missed here? What needs to be done, or what points need to be stressed to, you know, address, allay these concerns on the part of certain policy communities?
So the ANS and the ANS Washington office has actually been pretty actively engaged on this issue. In fact, we were just up on the Hill today meeting with Foreign Relations Committee staffers on this issue. I think that the overall outlook for Vietnam is good, and I suspect that the agreement will go into force at the end of that 90 days. There are issues that surround this. There are a small number of people that insist, in sort of a very doctrinaire fashion, that the U.S. not consider any 123 agreement unless there's a blanket prohibition on enrichment and reprocessing technologies. That again is a sort of, it's attractive at first blush, right? We should use our position to stop the spread of enrichment and reprocessing. But I think the more people begin to realize the rights that non-weapon states have under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, I think that when they realize that every time, if there are instances where we don't finalize 123 agreements with other nations that are interested in building nuclear, we leave the door open to our competitors, and that we may find ourselves 5 to 10 years down the line with a lot less influence over the development of their programs. I think people are beginning to realize that it is good for us to stay engaged. And I'm encouraged that among the Senate offices we've talked to, we're talking to some House offices now, that there really is a realization that the value of engagement is an important component to our nonproliferation policy as a nation, and that staying out of the game will have a negative impact on our nonproliferation policy, and that's not what anybody wants.
Just a final question for this interview. So small modular reactors, or SMRs, are certainly the hot topic currently for the U.S. nuclear industry and policy discussions regarding the future of nuclear power in the U.S. How do you believe SMRs potentially represent a solution for reinvigorating the domestic nuclear sector in the U.S., as well as also sharpening the competitiveness of the nuclear industry internationally?
So let me start by saying I think SMRs are really cool. I love I think the concept is incredibly engaging. They offer some very interesting safety advantages. I think that the key about SMRs, whereas you've seen the generation 2 and 3 plants getting bigger and bigger to take advantage of economies of scale at the plant site, now with SMRs, you're talking about economies of production, building them in a factory setting, having more consistent quality control on the front end, the modularity of their design, where you can bring them in on a truck bed or a rail car, and the assembly on site is fairly simplified over the quote stick-built plants of today. Obviously, the real question is, at what point do you achieve economies of production? Mm-hmm. at what point is the nth plan competitive with other forms of you know, generation? And you know, there's some studies out there. The University of Chicago, EPIC, has done a very interesting study on SMR. I think the earliest study was that if they did it right after the 12th plant, you would be in that sweet spot. I understand they may be doing an update of that report, and we're looking forward to seeing that. But again, the time will tell. What the real X factor here is how the regulatory process plays out, how quickly you can get design certifications for these plants, and then how can you attract interest from the investor community to actually put these in place? Who's going to be first? Because you need some early adopters to prime the production pump. And I mean, we believe, ANS believes, that the federal government ought to be an eager lead customer for SMR technology for its military installations,
sure.
DOE installations. And so, and we actually don't think the administration is doing enough there. Mm. It needs to do more to be an eager lead customer. One of the things that we need to see happen is a change in the way that the government treats power purchase agreements, so they can sign longer term agreements that don't score right away as being a big expense right up front. But I do think that if you look at the map of power plants around the country, electricity generation around the country, you'll see this mesh of 100 to 300 megawatt coal plants in the Midwest. And those match up very nicely with the capabilities of SMRs. You've got the transmission infrastructure already in place. You have so you can see where the market might be in the long term. And if we're going to get serious about carbon, we're going to need non-emitting generation capacity to replace some of that aging coal capacity. And nuclear is probably really well. I mean, it is really well suited for that. So, the proof of concept still needs to happen. The federal government is obviously, through DOE and the SMR program, committed to help offset some of the costs of the initial development of these SMRs. Mm-hmm. But it's the investor community that's really going to have to stand up and make these things a reality. And the customer base is going to have to come forward. So all of those things still have to happen, but it is a very promising technology, and a lot of people within ANS are really excited about it.
Mr. Piercy, this has been tremendously educational. Thank you so much for your time and answering all of our questions today.
My pleasure. Thank you.